From WGCU, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. In a place called the Sunshine State, you'd think solar power would be the dominant source of energy. Finally, it's coming to the fore, with Florida Power & Light boasting a dozen solar energy plants. Private citizens are also making the investment, installing their own panels, storing solar energy, and harnessing the state's most marketed resource, sunshine. We'll talk with power companies and solar power pioneers about what's taken so long and where things are headed. Plus, this is the time of year for fasting for certain religions. Catholics and some other Christians will forego meat on Fridays for Lent, and numerous other religions will celebrate springtime holidays, which involve food rules and restrictions. But where did these rules come from? We'll talk with an FGCU professor of history about where these traditions came from and how they've evolved. Plus, we'll talk with a local chef about local fish options that aren't the ubiquitous grouper and snapper for those seeking to expand their Fish Fridays. But first, the news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Food rules and religion seem to go hand in hand, and they have for centuries. Almost all religions observe some sort of fasting at various times of year, and springtime sees fish taking a prominent role on Fridays for many Christians, mostly Catholics. But what is at the root of fasting rules? There have been conspiracy theories, economics, and edicts throughout the ages. So to sort it all out, we have Dr. Melody Eichbauer in the studio with us today. She's a professor of medieval history who's been researching the confluence of the church and government through the ages. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm so glad to have you in the room. I just can't wait to ask you a million questions. And also a little bit later in this show, we're going to hear from a local chef and sustainable food advocate, Melissa Talmadge of Sweet Melissa's Cafe on Sanibel Island. With fish front and center, the temptation to focus on the big two from the Gulf, snapper and grouper, is always present. But she'll tell us about some of the other fish in the sea who are often overlooked and underfished. We are talking about fish. Why do we have fish Fridays? We're going to trace the roots of religious fasting through the ages. Do you have a question or a comment? Give us a call at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK, or you can find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Dr. Melody Eichbauer, where did the idea of abstaining from meat and eating fish first come from?
Okay, well, fasting, so to offer a little bit of background, fasting is simply abstaining from food from sunup, sundown for a certain amount of time. And it can also be abstaining from a certain or particular type of food. Now, fasting's been important it's still important in the Judaic tradition, and it's been part of the Catholic tradition, and it goes all the way back. Even though John the Baptist wasn't Catholic, we can trace that line of thinking back to that point. And we see it in the Bible in Luke, in Matthew, and Mark, and Paul called for it in the Acts of the Apostles. Now, the Didaschics, which is the earliest code of canon law in roughly 100, had 16 canons, very, very small. But chapter 8 dealt with fasting for Catholics or for Christians. And it was Wednesdays and Fridays. And by the 400s, Wednesdays were dropped, Saturday was put in, but even by the mid-400s, Saturday was dropped out. Now, with respects to the Lenten fast, originally the Lenten fast for the first 300 years of the church was only 2 to 3 days. And what happened is in 325 at the Council of Nicaea, Canon 5, which was really dealing a lot with Easter and whatnot, prescribed 40 days of fasting in preparation for baptism, and you get the number 40 from Moses, Elijah, and of course Jesus is 40 days in the desert, in the wilderness, dealing with temptation. Sundays were a free day. So what happened is until the 9th century, you had, unlike a normal fast with the sun up to sundown, you also had a prohibition against eating meat-based products such as eggs, milk, cheese, butter, and fish. So all of that was forbidden until the 9th century.
Total vegetarian or vegan, actually.
Correct. Okay. Correct. Then what happened is slowly these prohibitions began to relax, and by the 9th century, beginning about in the 9th century, you have fish being allowed. By the 1400s, you were allowed to take a small meal in the middle of the day. Normally, you know, it was after Vespers.
Yeah.
Right. It was after Vespers, which was about 6 o'clock. And so slowly but surely, these things began to relax. And then in 1781, Pope Pius VI made a distinction between fast days and days of abstinence. So technically, the fast days are Ash Wednesday and Good Friday. And that's the standard, shouldn't be eating, sun up to sundown. If you do, then you have It should not be meat or fish. The days of abstinence are every other day on Lent, and technically Fridays if you're a good Catholic throughout the entire year. You can only eat fish, not meat or meat. Meat-based products are now permitted, but meat is not.
Okay. So I've heard tales dating back to the Middle Ages, which is where your specialty is, that a crooked pope knew that someone in the fishing industry wanted to stabilize his income. He had a friend that was in the fishing industry, and he wanted to make his income a little bit more, you know, stable. Right, right. So that pope then went through with an edict and a rule that made everyone eat only fish on certain days and tried to expand the number of days that people had to eat fish. Is that true?
No. I love my papal conspiracy theories, but no. Basically, I mean, think logically about this. Fish is easy to preserve. And so not only can you catch it fresh, but then it's also easy to preserve, like pickled herring. But also in terms of meat, it was a very special commodity because you didn't have grazing cattle or milk cattle. Your cattle actually worked. So if you wanted to eat delicious Bessie, who's going to pull your plows? And so most of the slaughter of animals happened in November, and it was only those animals that they knew could not make it throughout the winter. And so that's where you saw a lot of – during the holiday season, right?
Well, that would have been some rough meat though.
Right. Well, when do we overindulge typically? Right around the holidays. When were most of the animals slaughtered? In right around November, before the first, you know, just before the first really, this the
when
winter
it gets cold.
Yeah, when the weather's starting to turn.
Isn't it interesting how these agrarian rhythms will influence the type of religious holidays that will happen at different times of the year?
Absolutely, absolutely. So fish was just easier to obtain and easier to preserve than. Meat, which yes, you could preserve it with milk, cheese, and butter, but you also don't want to have to kill your animals.
Yeah,
you
actually, they're kind of useful.
Yeah, pigs were the ones that grew quickly, and that tended to be the main source of meat.
And therefore, we have prosciutto.
Yeah, delicious.
Yes, it's a really good thing to have. Now, I wanted to talk about the fish. You said herring, and herring was the main fish, but it seems like I want to take a quote from an NPR story that I read. Believe it or not, NPR. Christians' religious appetite was largely met with herring, a fish that was plentiful but dry and tasteless when smoked or salted. And preservation was a must in medieval times. There was no good way for fresh fish to reach the devout masses. Eventually, cod became all the rage. It tasted better when cured, and it lasted longer. So cod was kind of a Viking thing.
Yeah.
When did the Vikings come into contact with those to the south?
Since they started raiding them for spring break purposes.
For spring break purposes.
That's how I always say it.
So that's how they ended up getting the cod then.
Well, and also the lowlands area, which are Denmark, Belgium, and that upper region there that are below sea level. That's why they're called lowlands and they have very nice dikes. They were instrumental in the fish trade. So they would have just like fishermen today use kites. That's what they would fish with. And the trading routes were very sustainable. And so it was very easy to move product, whether it's up and down rivers or just through very established land routes. So it was just – it was very easy to acquire.
Is there any study into the use of cod and the increase in the prevalence of cod as opposed to herring that may indicate – I mean, could that have become more popular as a result of some of these religious observances?
No, I think it just became more popular because of a taste. I know –
evolved taste.
Yeah, some people have a hankering for mullet. I have never been that person. So yeah. It just depends upon your fish preference.
All right. So did religions borrow traditions from one another way back in the beginning when they were first beginning? Because when you spoke earlier, you talked about Judeo-Christian.
Yeah.
So you have the beginning. I mean, all the Abrahamic religions mm-hmm. tend to have these types of fasting things, and it tends to be against meat.
Yes.
Not against, but I mean,
right.
That's the excluded product.
Yeah, exactly. Hoofed animals.
Warm-blooded.
Exactly.
So cold-blooded was fair game.
Yeah, and also I truly believe it had a lot to do with the economics. You do not want to slaughter your limited livestock unnecessarily. It was expensive to replace livestock, especially when you have feudalism. You have to pay the lord to have partake in their breeding stock. You had to make sure you had enough animals to plow. You had to make sure you had sheep for wool. That was big, so obviously you wouldn't want to be eating the mutton. So it just came down to an economic issue. When fish, they're delicious, but they didn't plow a field.
Yeah, and there were some writings in the 15th century that I was reading of people just wishing for the days when they could have their warm-blooded animals when they could, because they got tired of fish after a while.
Yes, and in England you had land law or forest law is what it was called, and that's no hunting on the King's Forest. That's where you get your Robin Hood tales from. And so there would be prohibitions on hunting on not only in England when you see forest law, but also you see if it's the king's land, you can't hunt on the king's land if it was in France or even in Germany, it would be the Holy Roman Emperor. So there the only really sustainable protein, so to speak, that you could get consistently throughout the year would be fish.
And now how have things evolved recently? You mentioned when we talked earlier about Vatican II and how that really altered things.
Yeah. So what you see happening is and I was just sort of looking at the Catholic Council of Bishops website along with the 1983 Code of Canon Law. And you see one of the things that's made the church so sustainable throughout the years is throughout the centuries, they have adapted and changed to their environment to a certain extent. So for instance, the Catholic Council of Bishops recommend fasting for those ages 18 to 59. But if you look at the 1983 Code of Canon Law, the age is 14 to 60. And so you have a small variance in terms of age to suit that particular population. And I think why 18, not being a cleric, but why it's 18 is if you look at the parochial schools, Good Fridays will be, I think a lot of times it's a lunch of rice and vegetables. It's because it's school age kids, mm-hmm. As opposed to 14 where, if you're 15, sorry about that. You're out of luck. 14 here. Yeah. Have whatever you want.
So we talked about salt cod and then bacala, which is what it's called over in Italy. That was the best of the best back in the day. But fast forward to today, and there is no better place to be a pescatarian for spiritual or other reasons. But for some reason, with all the fish in the Gulf, we tend to hear only about grouper and snapper in our area. They're tasty and all, but not as sustainable as a number of other fish. And that's why we have Chef Melissa Talmadge joining us from Sweet Melissa's Cafe on Sanibel Island. Melissa, thanks for taking the time out to talk with us today right in the middle of season. I know it's a really busy time.
Yeah.
Sorry. So as a chef, what species of fish do you use the most in your restaurant?
Redfish, cobia. I'm trying to, as much as I possibly can, incorporate more and more mullet. I jump on pompano. The purveyors do a really good job of trying to secure local pompano. So I'll always grab that when I ever see that available.
Do you think that there are fish that are locally available that are just kind of overlooked by people in favor of snapper and grouper because they know the name of those?
Yes. I mean, mullet, I mean, is the one that comes to mind. It's so plentiful out there, and it's such a fish that can hold up to so many different preparations, whether it's smoking or poaching or grilling. And I would love to see it used more and more.
Do you ever see mullet out at fish markets?
No. I actually, when I use the mullet that I get is from the Bait Box, which is a bait shop here on the island. And I call him, sometime in the afternoon, and I said, I need 30 pounds of mullet. And the next afternoon, I have 30 pounds of mullet showing up on my back door.
Okay, I've never had mullet. What is it like?
It's a little bit oilier and heavier than, your normal fish, which is why it stands up to so many different preparations. I think that maybe because it's not so readily available and it's not maybe prepared the right way is why people have, a bad connotation or they don't have, the most, receptive, they're not the most receptive to it. I don't know why. I would love to be able to get it. I mean, they tend to be a smaller fish. I don't know why fish markets don't have it or carry it.
Do you think they need a name change because, mullet is kind of a very out-of-style hairdo? I mean, that could not be helping their cause.
No, I guess not. I guess not. I mean, I don't know what else you would call it.
There are fish that suffer from bad name recognition, but are there any other fish that you can think of that are available out in the Gulf? I mean, you mentioned pompano. How about tilefish? Are there any others that you would jump on if you see it coming from the fishmonger?
Like I said, I mean, I try to keep the fish as local as possible. So cobia, pompano, redfish, golden tilefish is also a good one that I like to use very often. Just because golden tilefish, to me, actually has a little bit of the same texture as a grouper. So I would prepare it as I would prepare a grouper.
Is it hard to sell that to people? Or, I mean, are people kind of fixated on the grouper and snapper? Is it hard to, I mean, I guess you would really have to train your servers to really talk to people about the different kinds of
yes,
fish.
Yes, the servers are trained and understand why I am trying to push this. And I'm, you know, on the island, I'm pretty lucky. It's a pretty savvy population out here, so they get it. They educate themselves. So, you know, between all of the, you know, SCCF and the Sanibel Sea School, there's lots of organizations that are trying to educate them as to what the best choices are, and I'm just, you know, giving them those options here.
Yeah. And okay, so can you give me a quick pro tip as to what fish would you suggest for someone that's trying to change up their fish routine that is already familiar with grouper or snapper? What would be one that, if they see it, they should probably try to pick it up and prepare
cobia.
It in some of the same ways?
Cobia is a very light fish. It's very easy to cook. You know, that's what I would probably suggest.
Okay, and I wanted to quickly ask you about your house-cured Botarga. What is that?
I worked with Botarga in a couple of the restaurants that I first worked in New York and in New Orleans, and I fell in love with the product. And it's the roe of either a bluefin tuna or a mullet that's just sort of salt-packed and cured. And I was reading an article in the New York Times about a guy out of Tampa who's making his own mullet and sending it up north at like $97 a pound. And I was like, oh, wait, I could do that. So I called Ralph Wooding and I'm like, hey, is there any way I can get some roe? And I just started making it here. And I use it where I would use anchovies, you know, so I will use it in a Caesar dressing. And currently, you know, we're doing a menu change, so I'm doing a mullet fritter, and we're going to make an aioli, you know, with the Botarga aioli to really, you know, maximize the mullet, you know, on both ends.
Maximum mullet. So Botarga is, you said it's like a salt-cured roe?
It's salt-cured roe.
And now, is it like a solid, and you like shave it on things, or you just kind of sprinkle it
you
on?
You can shave it on things, you know, or break it up.
Oh, okay.
So what? Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to thank you for. What were you going to say?
Oh no, it just has a very salty, almost like an anchovy, like salty, like fishy texture to it.
So you could use it in place of like anchovies in like a Caesar salad or something.
That's the easiest way to, you know, get people to wrap their mind around what it is like.
Yeah. All right. Great. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for your time today. We're going to have to leave
Absolutely.
It there because we've run out of time. But I want to thank our guest, Chef Melissa Talmadge with Sweet Melissa's Cafe on Sanibel, and also Dr. Melody Eichbauer, who gave us a great background on the history of fish for the fasting days. Thanks for being here.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith and directed by Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida. Whether it's cool, oh, what a spot for whistling like a fool. What a fine day to take a stroll and wander by the fishing hole. I can't think of a better way to pass the time of day. We'll have no need to call the roll when we get to the fishing hole. There'll be you, me, and old dog Trey to doodle time away. If we don't hook a perch or bass, we'll cool our toes in dewy grass, or else pull up a weed to chaw and maybe set and jaw. Hanging around, taking our ease, watching that hound, a scratching at his fleet. Come on, take down your fishing pole and meet me at the fishing hole. I can't think of a better way to pass the time of day.